This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 4th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Today, our focus is on film, and up for discussion, we have the critically acclaimed The Forbidden Room by Canadian director Guy Maddin, plus a possible Oscar winner for Lily Tomlin in Grandma, and a new comedy by director Jonathan Levine, The Night Before. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. For this week's film review, I'm joined by Little White Lies editor David Jenkins. Welcome to the show, David. This week, we're going to begin with a bit of a surreal cinematic romp, the cryptic synopsis for The Forbidden Room by Guy Maddin and Evan Johnson reads like this. It says, a submarine crew, a feared pack of forest bandits, a famous surgeon, and a battalion of child soldiers all get more than they bargained for as they wend their way towards progressive ideas on life and love. Now, David, the film has been described as an esoteric fantasy. Does it have any dramatic connective tissue that you can call a plot?
Well, just to bring you up on your synopsis there, I think that maybe with this movie, Guy Maddin has created the hardest task in the world in trying to write a synopsis which actually covers what this film
is
about.
That's what I figured.
So actually trying to describe it now is, I'm kind of almost lost for words, I guess. But it is this insane, I think the term exquisite corpse is used. You know those stories where you have one story, then it goes on to another, someone else does another story, then another story. The kind of guiding concept behind it is Guy Maddin has collected all these movies that were either lost or never made. So they were just a kernel of an idea. And he's created this one film which kind of reimagines them all and kind of splurges them all together into one movie. And so you're watching one movie for about 5 minutes, and then there'll be this transition, quite a surreal transition through to a completely different movie and then a completely different movie. So it's like kind of sketches of movies.
Well, let's have a little listen to what that sounds like. Here's a clip from The Forbidden Room.
I don't understand you. You beg me to come meet you here, you need to talk, and then you make me wait for hours? A man could easily kill you.
Sorry, did you steal my boar's head?
Yes. No. Maybe.
Ah, you thought you would get away. You did not. You will face the volcano. Dream the molten dream of justice.
That was the sound of The Forbidden Room. Now, Maddin has a very unique style. He's been obsessed with silent movies and the sort of in-between period after silent movies. How does this manifest itself in this film?
Well, I mean, it is a kind of, as with all his movies, it is a kind of love song to that period. And you get the impression from watching his films that I think he wished he'd maybe been born 50 years earlier so he could have been maybe making art during that time. He just kind of builds on all the tropes of those movies. He loves like using intertitles and, you know, using irony to make them funny. And he also loves the fact, I mean, he's interested in the idea that those movies are now kind of historical relics in and of themselves.
Quite stylized.
Yeah, they're kind of decayed. The prints are all kind of, you know, they just don't look good. They're decaying things. And I think he sees himself as a kind of cinephile superhero who wants to kind of save them in some form or another. I think in The Forbidden Room, what he does is probably his most kind of wacky and stylized movie, because along with his co-director, Evan Johnson, he's actually he's actually not using actual celluloid. He's with using digital. He's kind of created that effect of decaying celluloid that kind of and uses it to sort of splice these little mini epics together.
A 2-hour film, but quite a modest budget. Can you talk a little bit about the production design and a little bit more about the kind of costume and the look of this film?
Well, it's interesting to note that actually the film was the product of a project that he was doing called Seances, and it was set in the Pompidou Centre. And what he did is he invited a lot of his kind of actor friends to come and drop in and do a scene with him and then go away. So you have all these people like Udo Kier, Matthew Amalric and Charlotte Rampling, who are all in just a tiny little bit of the film. And it kind of shows how that method worked. People just dropping in, doing a little crazy scene and then moving out again. So, I mean, I guess that was a way to sort of save the budget. But yeah, I mean, he's very, very industrious when it comes to using, you know, digital effects, real things, mixing them together. And I think he likes that kind of quite ironic juxtaposition between the two, like, you know, where you've got the kind of the modern and the antiquated there in the same scene. And I mean, that's something that's, again, goes through all his work.
As a Canadian myself, I find it strange when you look at directors like David Cronenberg, Atom Egoyan, Guy Maddin. I mean, we're normally quite a sort of safe, boring culture, and yet our filmmakers have this very bizarre bent. What is Guy Maddin's kind of reputation as a filmmaker?
I mean, you know, his reputation is he's like a singular presence. He's in and of himself, he's alone. There's no one else doing what he does. And, you know, I think there are people who kind of think that maybe all his films are possibly a bit too similar. Like, you know, when you go to see a Guy Maddin film, you kind of get what you expect, really. But, yeah, I mean, he has got this kind of formidable reputation. And I think The Forbidden Room is, from what I've seen of his work, is definitely up there with his best, though. I mean, it's kind of interesting because his previous film called Keyhole was maybe not as it was really similar to this one, but actually I found it quite tedious and, you know, taking the whole Guy Maddin thing a little too far. Whereas The Forbidden Room, it's almost the same look, same feel, but there's just something about it that's so fresh and vital and funny. And it although I must say, I took my wife to see it at the London Film Festival when it was on, and she just slept the whole way through. I mean, there are some people who are just not on that wavelength, and That's it with Guy, I think.
The Forbidden Room premiered at the Sundance Film Festival is now out in the UK and France, and it will no doubt be rolling out in film festivals around the world. Let's move on now to Grandma. In the film, Lily Tomlin plays the character of an aging poet mourning one lover and on the verge of dumping her next when she receives an unexpected visit from her granddaughter in need of some cash for an abortion. And so begins a day-long road trip. Now, David, what kind of journey does this film take us on?
Well, as you might have guessed, it is a journey of self-discovery of some sort. but it is a very charming one, and it's interesting in that this film has been made by the director Paul Weiss, who has spent a career making these, you know, his debut movie was American Pie. So he, you know, he has set a very specific type of stall for himself, and he has been making for the last, got you know, two decades these big Hollywood movies. And I think this is his kind of, no, I want to do something of my own. I want to make it small and modest and honest and passionate and just do what I want to do. And this film is the result of that. And as such, you know, it is quite, you know, there is a sort of convention to it, like that comes from his background. But there is also more, you know, the subject matter is quite risky, especially in America. I mean, you're potentially alienating a certain type of maybe perhaps right-wing audience who might not be enthused by the subject matter. But I mean, it's a very charming film version of quite a conventional story, I guess.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip from the film now. This is The Sound of Grandma.
I need some help, Grandma.
Okay.
I need $600, $630.
For what?
I'm pregnant.
Who is he? A one-night stand?
No, ew. He's kind of my boyfriend.
Yeah. Why didn't you use a condom? Or for humanity's sake, get a vasectomy?
Look, who is this?
It's my grandma.
You know, I cut my credit cards up into little pieces. I made a wind chime out of them.
Why would you do that? Why are you selling those books?
I need some cash. I need $500.
Listen, Grandma, you better watch yourself.
Give us the money.
A clip from the film Grandma, and the lead player there, the 76-year-old Lily Tomlin, who is one of the comic gifts to cinema. What kind of role does this offer her?
Well, this is it's an interesting film because it's actually, I think, looking back over her career, it seems that it's actually maybe her first ever lead performance in a film. She is the kind of, you know, ever since she was in Robert Altman's Nashville in the 70s, she has been the kind of perennial supporting player. You know, maybe people have thought that her kind of presence is maybe a bit too much to take on the lead. But I think they'll be kicking themselves now seeing Grandma and seeing the ease and with which she, you know, holds this film on her shoulders, I think.
She's never actually had an Oscar. People are saying, could this be her first at the age of 76?
I mean, I think it's a really strong field this year. So, you know, it would have to be, you know, it's a long shot, I think. But it would be great if that could happen in recognition of all her sort of services to cinema.
Let's move on a little bit to the film itself. It's been billed as a comedy. But are there more layers of meaning within the script?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, although you have this kind of journey narrative which takes them to these various people and these meetings, there is a kind of that the focus is on this three generations of a family. You have the granddaughter who's with Lily Tomlin, who's the grandmother, and then in the middle you've got this presence that you don't see for quite a while, who's the mother figure, Lily Tomlin's daughter, who has become slightly estranged from her. So there is the kind of the plot that this journey allows them to kind of communicate with themselves, with each other in a new way, and ultimately kind of brings them together a bit more. But yeah, I think it's an interesting film because, I mean, as I say before, it's a political film, mm-hmm. although I think it's questionable whether it's essentially I don't think it's a film that's espousing abortion necessarily. And I don't think it's a film that is saying that, you know, it doesn't take a political side. It just tells a kind of very distant story about this thing that's happening, a woman who wants to get her granddaughter an abortion. And I don't think there's any kind of
message
to the movie. It's not saying, oh, this was a great thing for her or this was a terrible thing for her. I mean, it's a very honest portrayal of that kind of journey, I guess. Which is really great. I mean, it's one of the, you know, and it's just very, it's very subtle and laid back and low key and you know, all those things, and it's all the better for it. I think it doesn't try to make those big statements, and but it ends up making them without trying, if you know what I mean.
Lovely to have a bit of subtlety. Well, Grandma is out now in the US, Spain, and Sweden, and will be rolling out in cinemas around the world in the upcoming weeks. Now, finally, we're going to finish today's show on a lighter festive note with The Night Before, directed by Jonathan Levine and starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Seth Rogen and Anthony Mackie. The film follows three friends as they celebrate a last ritual Christmas Eve of debauchery. Now, David, can you colour in the plot a little bit more for us?
Well, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character is recently bereaved. His parents have died. And in the beginning of the film, Seth Rogen and Anthony Mackie kind of scoop him out of the doldrums and take him to get drunk. And so that becomes their kind of annual Christmas tradition. They're the kind of ad hoc family. They're going to come together every year and, you know, get drunk together, basically. And that's their tradition. And then they decide one year that, you know, they're on the cusp of adulthood. They're all going their separate ways. They're professional. It's got to end. And this year is going to be the final blowout. And Joan Gordon-Levitt's character, Ethan, manages to snag tickets to this mythical party that's going on every year, which they kind of always hear about but never get invited to. And so they decide to make this the big blowout that will be their final Christmas together.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip from the movie The Night Before.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the borough the children were snuggled, their presents wrapped thorough. But this tale's not about presents, or Santa, or ponies. It's about three dudes, three bros, three ride-or-die homies.
And that was a little teaser for the film The Night Before. Now, does this film offer a new take on the Christmas movie?
No. Sorry, it just really doesn't. It's kind of what it's trying to, I think it's trying to kind of fuse together the kind of frat boy comedy, drunken, taking drugs, doing silly things. And it's trying to kind of co-opt the spirit of Christmas and what it means to come together and be a family and give gifts to people and, you know, tell people you love them. And it's one of those films that it wants more than it's allowed to have, and it can't have both. And it kind of doesn't really work on either level as either a kind of out and out spirit of Christmas movie or an out and out crazy dudes getting blottoed movie as well. So
what about the humor? Is it funny?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that you know, in the leads, you've got the three main characters are intended to be the funny people, you know, especially, I mean, someone like Seth Rogen, he is a very funny person. However, and I don't know whether this is down to the script or the performance or the direction, but there's just not that many laughs coming from that sort of central trio. However, there is a supporting cut player, Michael Shannon, who plays the men's ex-high school teacher, who's now a drug dealer, who he has a kind of Dickensian returning role where he meets them and they smoke drugs in his car and they have these visions of the future and the past. And he somehow manages, without doing any shtick, without doing, just reading, deadpanning his lines, which don't have any kind of ostensible jokes in them, he manages far and away to be the funniest presence in the film. Every second he's on screen is worth five minutes of the other guys, I think. He is like tremendous.
It's interesting. The director, Jonathan Levine, said that a lot of the scenes were improvised. Did you have a sense of this? Do you think it added, or perhaps is that why maybe some of the humor fell flat?
I didn't know that to start with, but actually you telling me that now, I wouldn't. I'm not batting an eyelid here.
yeah, I bear witness to that.
yeah, that does figure. It definitely has that kind of slightly loosey-goosey feel to it, and you know, I think that's probably why.
A little more discipline.
Yeah, that maybe could have helped.
Well, The Night Before has already been released in the US of A, Canada and Germany. And for the rest of the world, you can expect pre-Christmas screening openings very near you very soon. Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. David Jenkins, thank you very much, as always, for joining us here in studio. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. My producer was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time on Monday when we'll be talking art. But for now, thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.